So hi Keenan, thanks for coming on the podcast. Could you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so I'm an investigator, tenure track investigator at National Institute on Aging in the intramural research program. So that's for those not aware of it, because I know there's many who deal with the NIH who aren't aware of the intramural program. It's the NIH's own laboratories, and we, you know, do research just like other academic institutes. But of course, it's NIH funded. And so that's the side of the NIH that doesn't allocate sort of grants, right? The other side, the extramural program, is most people are familiar with. And that's the side, you know, university professors, for example, will apply to receive funding from. So I've been at NIH intramural program for about 3 years. And I run a lab now that does Alzheimer's disease research. So, you know, we focus on omic techniques like proteomics and genetics, and we apply that to, outcomes that are relevant to, you know, progression of Alzheimer's disease and understanding the disease pathology. And this is all done almost exclusively in the context of humans. So we work with MRIs, PET imaging. We work with fluid biomarkers, including blood and CSF. And yeah, we try to put the pieces together to understand the disease biology.
Mm-hmm. And what got you interested in this research?
What got me interested in it? Well, I'm by training a neuropsychologist. So that's a subspecialty of clinical psychology, where the focus of that effort is really to diagnose and classify, describe neuropsychiatric conditions. So it ranges from, you know, pediatric stuff like, you know, learning disabilities to geriatric conditions like Alzheimer's disease, dementia, you know, things like traumatic brain injury and epilepsy, for example. So I had a chance to work with a lot of these patient populations in training, graduate programs, postgraduate programs. And we have this program called, or the stage in our training called internship, where you get to do a full after you do your PhD program, you do your internship, and it's a time where you do full-time clinical work. And it's sort of like the residency for clinical psychology. Mm-hmm. So at that point, I sort of understood that, I really liked working with aging populations, but I felt like as a clinician, there wasn't a whole lot we can offer them beyond diagnosis.
Yeah.
And, you know, recommendations was oftentimes, I think, only go so far. So I, from that point on, and it was, you know, largely leading up to it, I really focused a lot of my attention on the research end of things, with the idea that hopefully I can, you know, be a part of, you know, improving care, you know, identifying therapies, you know, advancing diagnostics. And I feel personally a lot more effective as a scientist, as a former clinician, in this position. And I do like the day-to-day a lot more. But I think, you know, Alzheimer's and dementia itself is like a very fast-paced, complex area to be doing research in. And that's part of what drew me to it. I like the fact that there's a lot of Alzheimer's researchers. There's a lot of great science going on all the time, and every day there's a new, you know, impactful publication where, you know, we're constantly learning. And that, to me, that non-static, dynamic nature of the science is really cool, in my opinion. And it's great to be a part of. It's like a big research community, but it's still small enough that, you know, you really feel like
can't connect with people if it's so big, where, like, yeah, won't know A lot of people know the main names in Alzheimer's. Were you always interested in science, even as a kid, or was it something that developed later on?
Always pretty much interested in science, and to a lesser degree, it was mostly science. Yeah. But the actual type of science ranged broadly. Mm. I mean, I went through a lot of phases. There was a time where I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. Oh. And that was like in high school too. So that was fairly like close to when I had to make a decision. I was really interested in earth science and meteorology before that. And so it's nice. I've gone through a lot of different phases where I get really interested in something and try to buy books and learn as much as I can about it. And they're not very like disparate areas. I think it all sort of helps make me a more well-rounded person and scientist. But largely it's been various types of earth and life sciences. Well, I guess and physical sciences. And it wasn't until college when I took like a cognitive neuroscience course that I really thought that psychology, neuroscience, and some marriage of the two would be a good place to go for me. But I even at that point didn't really know postgraduate, like what options there were. I sort of was leaning more toward the psychology side, got into a clinical psychology program, found out I really did not like therapy. I thought it was something, it was one of those situations where I could have definitely benefited from extra exposure before committing. Sort of what I had in my head in terms of like being a clinical psychologist versus like the actual day-to-day was really different. But luckily, neuropsychology wasn't also an option too. And I had a neuroscience, ish background. So I was able to jump into that and excel. My interests are fairly broad, and it's the fact that I landed on Alzheimer's disease and science, probably could have been happy doing another type of science too. It's not something that it's this or nothing. So I think this is a great place if you're going to be a scientist. I think sort of neurosciences and dementia specifically is a place where you can really have an impact and solve, or at least try to solve, an extremely complex, maybe one of the most complex problems in the world. So I am happy, although it was a non-linear path. I'm definitely happy where I ended up.
And in terms of Alzheimer's, do you think there's a main cause, or do you think it's various different factors? Because you said it's complex, but I'm wondering if you think that there's like a certain causative agent, or it's just multiple things working together.
That's a really good question, and there is a debate. Well, I'd say there's probably a few different lines of thinking on this. I think broadly speaking, what Alzheimer's is by definition, and this is like a definition that's been it was pretty recent. It's changed from epoch to epoch. And right now, I think the field has landed on this idea that Alzheimer's disease technically is a condition whereby you have these two particular protein aggregates in the brain, right? That's amyloid beta and tau neurofibrillary tangles. So that amyloid beta plaques, tau neurofibrillary tangles. So when they accumulate to a certain extent, then by definition, you meet that biologic criteria for Alzheimer's disease. Doesn't mean you have dementia necessarily. It doesn't mean you have Alzheimer's dementia, but that's the disease. So I think there's pretty broad consensus on that, although some think that perhaps other factors should be included in that sort of biologic definition. But in my opinion, I think it's a good place to start that definition, and I agree with it. Like, we do need some sort of way to really differentiate it from other neurodegenerative conditions. Both of these types of pathology seem to be both necessary and sufficient. Not loud, but sufficient, maybe put an asterisk next to it, but to cause the Alzheimer's dementia. But I think how you get to that is very, how you get to a place of having plaques and tangles in your brain, that road can look very different depending on genetic predisposition, environmental exposure, and exposure to other chronic conditions. So I think you can get to Alzheimer's disease from many different ways, whether it be through significant vascular dysfunction, you know, and or metabolic syndrome, whether it be through exposure to certain toxicants that may promote, you know, progression of tau and amyloid. Mm-hmm. I think there's a final common pathway that is amyloid mm-hmm. and tau that gets you to the disease entity itself. But I think there's a lot of things that it can either trigger it, promote it, accelerate it. And these things are varied. And they're actually some of the processes that the in the recent paper have landed on. So that's, I guess, the... So, yeah, it is complex, but I think in summary, yeah, there's multiple ways that you can get to Alzheimer's disease.
But do you think a therapy should target amyloid or tau, or should it target one of the earlier processes to actually prevent it? Or do you think that's even possible?
So I think that this all depends on when you want to intervene. Mm. I think there's going to be... Say the disease process itself, I personally think, you know, at 30 years or more, you know, in duration, you know, it may really be a lot longer than that. And my group is finding some evidence that some of these biomarkers do change very, very early. I mean, in our paper, we show that, you know, some of these biomarkers that we can link back genetically to Alzheimer's disease appear to be altered in the fourth decade of life. There's evidence that, you know, amyloid itself, as measured on neuroimaging, you know, when looking at amyloid on the brain, it seems to reach that sort of threshold to be classified as amyloid positive in 20, you know, in some say even like 30 years before the onset of dementia itself. This is a very protracted disease process, and I think the optimal therapy or combination of therapies is going to vary depending on when in the disease process, you know, you can intervene. So I think really if you're very early, then maybe just sort of trying to block or remove amyloid plaques by itself may be very efficacious. I think once you're later in the disease process, you know, mild cognitive impairment, this prodromal phase of Alzheimer's disease or early Alzheimer's disease, which is where a lot of the trials now are enrolling participants. I think, you know, and the trials, some of the recent ones do show that blocking, removing amyloid at that phase can have some benefit, but the benefit is limited. Like you're seeing, you know, slowing of disease process about 20 to 30%. Mm-hmm. And so that means, and that's with optimal clearance of amyloid. Like you look on the brain, you give someone a treatment like donanemab, which is sort of Lilly's drug that was successful in phase 3 recently. So you give them that drug for a year, less than that actually, and I believe it's less. And largely, your brain goes from being very amyloid positive to being sub-threshold levels of amyloid, sort of consistent with someone which we typically classify as negative. And that's within a year. So these drugs are really good at removing plaques. But even in those people where plaques are completely cleared, on average, you're seeing 20 to 30% slowing. So that's like, if we're talking about stopping the disease in its tracks, or 70%, you know, that's still left, that's unaccounted for, that I think, you know, I think we've exhausted what we can do in terms of plaque clearance, because the drugs do that, you know, really well, yet we're still only getting so far. So then it's like, okay, do we need to address tau, neurofibrillary tangles, or soluble tau? Do we need to address neuroinflammation? I think there's all these other different pathways at that point in the disease stage that are active and are independent of amyloid driving the disease. And then that's like later, if we go early, I think, yeah, it's going to be about removing amyloid and probably some of the soluble forms that occur even before plaques emerge. Because I think that, and we have some evidence from one of our colleagues, that the soluble amyloid start to become abnormal well before plaques start to. So like, you know, do we need to work on clearing that? Or are we going to be more is sort of prevention of some of these conditions that we know increases dementia risk, particularly in midlife. Like, is that going to be more effective? Like, we know hypertension, diabetes, systemic inflammation, these things in the fourth or fifth decade of life are dementia risk factors, arguably are Alzheimer's disease risk factors. So I think that sort of preventative interventions are going to be important too. Those are hard to implement, right? Like, but yeah, so I think in general, it's going to come down the combination of interventions, and the interventions are not going to look the same for everyone. And it's going to be different depending on what stage of the disease process the person who needs to be intervened on is. And two people in the same disease stage might have different processes sort of driving disease progression. And I think biomarkers, such as some of the ones we identified, are going to be important for identifying like who's having their process being driven along by immune dysfunction versus who's having their process being driven along by, for example, you know, vascular proteostasis breakdown. I think when we can parse that out, then we can start to personalize the intervention a little bit more better.
How long do you think that would take to actually get this sort of information? Like, do you have an estimate, or do you think it's to actually predict?
I think it's a long can't predict. And these things do take a long time. Yeah. I think amyloid therapies are a great first step. And there's a push to do this, and cancer's been like the poster child for, you know, what some people call like this theragnostic approach, where you really apply biomarkers or look at genetics and determine what combination of therapies is going to be most appropriate for the person. And so I think first we need therapies that know can be effective. And then I think comes figuring out, okay, this therapy works broadly, but is there a subgroup for whom this works really well? Is there a subgroup for whom this doesn't work at all? And I'm fully certain that, like, if you look into the donanemab or lecanemab clinical trials that were positive, you'll find some people who responded extremely well to it, and you'll find a ton of people who didn't respond at all. And I think there's a few things we can do to try to figure out what separates those people. And then this is all post hoc analysis, so we'll want to do some sort of validation of that. But I think that sort of work is going to be, you know, in the long term, I think this is a sort of a multi-decade process, going to sort of iterate and improve intervention for Alzheimer's disease that way.
And now moving on to the paper, what are the three main findings? What do you say from the paper?
Three main findings. So I touched on one of them. I think broadly speaking, the proteomic signature, and this is just so it's clear to those who haven't read the paper, we really looked at the plasma proteome. So we're taking blood from people who are non-demented in middle age and between like fourth and sixth decade of life. We're taking blood in a big cohort of people who are non-demented and measuring about 5,000 proteins and seeing which proteins are predictive of future dementia risk over about a 2-decade follow-up period. So the fact that we see like a pretty strong signal, I think it's really neat, but I think it's just the beginning. It's like the first finding, and sometimes it gets overlooked, but there were people that when we started this didn't think that we'd be able to find a signal in the blood that early for a disease which takes place largely within the central nervous system, largely within the brain, you know, which is protected by this blood-brain barrier that is semi-impermeable, but still permeable to some extent, right? So we know from other studies, and we've done some work earlier showing that older adults, we see like in plasma that people at risk for dementia, meaning will get dementia in X amount of years, they have a different signature across a large segment of their proteome, like a large number of proteins. But then we backed it up using, you know, relying on the earlier wave of the study that we used called ERIC, which is the Atherosclerosis Risk and Community Study. Great resource for those interested in, you know, this sort of big data. We backed it up, so we were able to take samples from the 90s, early 90s, measure the same proteins in about 10,000 people who are, again, were non-demented. And we showed that a large segment of the proteome, you know, is perturbed or upregulated, downregulated in people who are at risk for dementia over this two-decade follow-up period. So that's the first finding. There is a signature in the proteome for the CNS disease that happens decades later or manifests decades later. I think the disease is clearly already happening in those middle-aged decades. From there, we did a number of things. One of the big, if we look at individual proteins, one of the big proteins that was most strongly associated with future dementia risk, you know, whether it be dementia within a 15-year follow-up period or dementia beyond that 15-year follow-up period, we're seeing that this one protein called GDF15, growth differentiation factor, I think it is, 15, was, you know, by far the strongest predictor. And this is a neat protein that's still not well understood in terms of brain neurologic disease, but it's this protein, it's also called macrophage inhibitory cytokine. You know, we think it has anti-inflammatory properties. It inhibits sort of cytokine expression in activated macrophage, which sort of dampens down the immune system. So we think it might be like a signal of some abnormal process taking place in the periphery outside the brain. What's neat about it when we look into it further is that it doesn't seem to be really expressed in the brain tissue, at least in measurable levels. So we think, yeah, this, we're looking at a signal that's coming from the rest of the body that seems to be strongly predictive of future dementia risk. And it seems like this is an immune signal. So right now we're following that up to try to understand what GDF15 does exactly. Like, we were able to examine the causal link between some of our proteins and Alzheimer's disease using genetic methods like Mendelian randomization. And we didn't find evidence that GDF15 itself was causally linked to Alzheimer's disease, but we think it's still possible that it's driving some other aspect of the disease process that can sort of tip the scale toward Alzheimer's disease. Like, it may have a strong role in, for example, the neuroimmune response or neuroinflammation. We do have some evidence for that. We show it's associated with one of the CSF biomarkers that's commonly used to capture neuroinflammation. So we have a lot of interest in that protein. Other people have found that same protein to be predictive of non-CNS diseases, including risk for mortality, risk for cardiac disease.
Strong is that link?
Very, if I'm remembering the hazard ratio, not to get too into the statistical weeds, but for every time the level of GDF15 doubles in blood, so every fold change increase in GDF15, we see about a 50% increase in dementia risk. So, you know, it's a pretty strong effect size. And then if you look at, like, the actual level of statistical significance, you see all the other proteins just pass this, you know, we call it Bonferroni threshold that adjusts for the number of comparisons. And then, like, well above everything else, you see GDF15. We were able to replicate this effect in two additional cohorts. And so that gives me a lot of confidence in that finding. One, just the sheer strength of it in our original cohort and their ability to, like, go to other continents. I think one was Whitehall 2, which is a UK study. The other was an Oxford-based study. And so we were able to look at a lot of our proteins in those two cohorts and show that some of the associations were replicated. Certainly not all of them. Ian was one of them. So, yeah, we're excited about that protein and either what it may tell us about the disease biology, the potential for therapeutic intervention on this pathway that, you know, it's involved in, or just understanding why it's such a good marker, biomarker. And so the other finding, there's a lot, if I can highlight, like, the third most important takeaway that I'm excited about is our attempt to understand the dynamics of different biologic processes that mm-hmm. change in the years leading up to dementia onset. So we were able to, we measured 5,000 proteins. We were able to actually cluster them together based mm-hmm. on protein co-expression, or really just essentially strong intercorrelation between various proteins. We were able to separate these 5,000 proteins in about 19 clusters. And these clusters are proteins that are more connected with each other than to other proteins that were available mm-hmm. to be measured. So we found a number of these clusters, you know, were predictive of future dementia risk, like the extent to which the cluster was expressed either reduced or increased your likelihood of developing dementia. And this, some of these clusters were more predictive like 20 years out. Some of these more clusters were more predictive like 10 to 15 years out. And so we were able to then see, sort of characterize the clusters biologically, and you know, with the hypothesis that proteins that sort of hang together in this data-driven analysis have similar or overlapping biology. And from that, we were able to really try to understand, you know, what processes, at least in the plasma proteome, seem to be most relevant, you know, to dementia risk. And one of the processes that came out as relevant, and it may not be a surprise, is immune function. But we were able to dig deeper into this idea that there's this perturbance in immune function on the road to Alzheimer's disease, on the road to dementia. But we were able to say, like, okay, if we parse out the immune system, you know, we see these pathways like sort of JAK-STAT signaling, which is a network of antiviral signaling that was suppressed in people at risk for dementia. We saw other aspects of immune signaling, like toll-like receptor activation, endothelial cell adhesion. So these aspects of innate immunity that at the same time were activated. So we see this pretty complex picture of how the immune system might be either affected by or affect risk for future dementia. And that actually changed when we looked closer to disease onset. We saw different aspects of the immune system were perturbed. Things like complement, which mm-hmm. play a lot of roles, inflammatory, ubiquitination. And we see coagulation also, sort of the hemostasis hemostasis effect sort of take more of a precedent at that 15-year period, where it wasn't so important like 20 years before dementia onset. So this is, I think, just a start of trying to understand the dynamic changes that occur on the road to dementia onset. But I think one of the high level takeaways here is that, yeah, it is complex. It does change depending on time before dementia onset. And we look at immune system specifically, it's not, oh, the immune system is overactivated, the immune system is overly suppressed. You really have to look at specific pathways within immunity, and that tells a more nuanced story that I think will be important to understand if we're going to target pathways like the immune system as a treatment.
I was curious because you found that the majority of proteins showed similar associations between men and women. Well, mm-hmm. why do you think that is the case, even though women have an increased risk of dementia?
Yeah, so you're right. Women do have an increased risk. Their prevalence of Alzheimer's disease specifically or dementia more broadly is higher than men. And I think despite that, there's more biologic similarity between what drives men and women mm-hmm. to dementia than there are dissimilarities. So mm-hmm. if we look at the proteins that are associated with dementia risk, for the most part, what's associated for dementia risk in men is also associated with dementia risk in women, although there were some notable exceptions. But yeah, I think that's just a function of really we're more alike than we are dissimilar. And this is a question I get asked a lot with respect to the sex differences, but also race differences. So I think just because protein, say it is causal and drives dementia risk, it could exert the same effect across men and women, but the protein, like the prevalence of elevations in the certain protein could be higher. So it's like the effect of the protein is the same, but women just tend to have higher levels, broadly speaking. And then the same thing with like hypertension or diabetes and dementia risk when we look across race groups, you know, they probably, in my opinion, affect, for example, black and white individuals the same, but we know black individuals tend to have higher levels of cardiovascular disease. And so that same effect that's more prevalent in a certain group yields more dementia in said group. And I think that may be a case of what's going on here. Some of the proteins are indeed causal. That's my take on that. I don't think it wasn't a whole lot to take away from the sex different angle.
You showed that men had increased clustrin and I think with serafina 3 association wise, while women had different proteins. I think it was FBL and that was new to me. I've never seen that protein before. I was quite curious about that.
So we're looking at 5,000. Some of these proteins have never been measured by other platforms. So there's a lot of new stuff here. And it's a lot to, I mean, I think at a threshold we were most interested in, we had about 30 proteins that met that threshold. Yeah, and some of them were very new to us, just as proteins and as dementia-related proteins.
Mm-hmm.
But why, for example, we saw differences in effects of like serpinA3 between men and women, I honestly don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's always a chance that it could be just, you know, a chance finding, but I think we'd have to replicate these associations, get a little cautious about interpreting subgroup associations because it's all like a post hoc exercise. Mm-hmm. But this, if we can replicate this finding, example where some protein is more strongly predictive or strongly associated with an outcome for one group than another. And so if both groups have the same amount, the group that's more affected can still see higher rates of the condition. But we don't know. I mean, I know serpinA3, just extending this example, is going back to the immune system, an immune-related protein. Mm-hmm. It's sort of involved in the acute phase response. And like it sort of co-aggregates in the brain with amyloid plaques. So it's something that's been on the radar of Alzheimer's and dementia researchers for some time. And like I said, it's involved in immunity. And we know that the male and female like immune system, although again, more alike than different, there are some major differences. And that's just shown in like, you know, the rates of severity of COVID infection between men and women, for example. Like there are differences in a lot of the Alzheimer's work that's looked into neuroimmune activation, you know, does show sex differences as well. So yeah, there's a good chance that we are seeing something that's real here when we see differences in serpinA3 or other immune proteins and their varying risk for dementia between the sexes. But those again were post hoc analysis, so we didn't dive too deep into them just yet.
Okay, and why do you think there was a difference in the pathways between the people who got dementia at a younger age compared to those who got it later? Like, do you think there's actually, like, because you showed there were different proteins being expressed at different levels. Do you think that's the causative thing that's causing some people to get it at earlier age? Or could it be just because they've got different kind of types of Alzheimer's disease?
Yeah, that's a good question. My interpretation, so we have, some pathways that are dysregulated seemingly about 20 years ahead of dementia onset, some pathways that are largely distinct, that are dysregulated, you know, about 10, 15 years before dementia onset. And I don't think, my interpretation was that on the way through dementia, an individual could see dysregulation in those 20-year pathways and those 10-year pathways, but at varying times in their disease course. So like, say we know in advance, this is actually something that they can do with autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease, which is pretty neat. But you can really estimate in autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease when someone is likely to develop dementia, depending on when their when their parent developed it. So say we knew that someone's going to develop dementia at 75. So we can then, based on our findings, we'd say, okay, at 55, we think there's going to be, based on our pathway analysis, dysregulation in, for example, let's say, we have like bile acid biosynthesis, or you know, some aspect of a matrix metalloproteases, granulocyte adhesion, like these pathways that were definitely perturbed 20 years before dementia onset. But as that, when that person advances from 55 to 65, then we see a different pattern of biologic responses. And here we see the biology be perturbed that we implicated within 15 years of dementia onset. More clear activation in immune response, for example. And so it's just the same person going through different phases of the disease process is what we think. Yeah, I mean, that's what was our take on it. I don't necessarily think it's too different. If you have this, you're going to develop dementia within 15 years. If you have dysregulation of that, you're going to have dementia within 25 years. I think both of those biologic systems, the 15 and the 25, are at play in the same person, but just at different times.
Why did you choose to study the EMIF-AD study and the other studies to compare it to? Was there a particular reason?
So the question, just some quick, did we use the EMIF study to compare it to? Okay, yeah, the EMIF study is particularly valuable because they have the same proteins measured, that using the same platform, which is great for replication. And it actually is, like, I think one of the greatest things about this sort of proteomics boom that we're in right now. But this group also has a number of very well-defined Alzheimer's disease and dementia biomarkers measured in cerebral spinal. And despite the advances in like the technology that allow for plasma biomarkers in Alzheimer's disease context to be pretty predictive, pretty reliable, like CSF is still looked at as the gold standard. So we were able to look at our proteins that we nominated, many of which were novel in regards to the link to Alzheimer's disease, say, okay, how does this, well, GDF15 correlate with a known canonical central Alzheimer's disease protein like amyloid, p-tau, and then we can also look at proteins like YKL40, which represents neuroinflammation. So, yeah, like for GDF15, we learned that it wasn't actually correlated with amyloid and tau, which was very surprising. Yeah, it was correlated with our neuroinflammation marker, which maybe that's less surprising given what we know about the protein, but it really gives the ability to use the EMIF cohort that had CSF and plasma biomarkers of the same proteins that we measured, I think, was very informative.
Showed that synaptic and autophagic proteins showed the opposite association for the midlife individuals compared to the late life individuals. Why do you think that was the case?
So that was a very interesting finding as well. And I think it goes to one of the points that I had brought up about, like, the effect of some of these pathways varies by point in the disease process. So if we're looking at 30 years of a disease process, you know, the synaptic proteins that, for example, are upregulated as a result, you know, maybe in the 20 years before disease onset, because, for example, you know, the synapses are working over time to try to stave off disease, right? Maybe it's a compensatory process. By the time you get closer to the onset of dementia, that compensatory process may be exhausted. You may have actually lost neurons. And as a result, you're seeing, you know, whereas something 20 years before was upregulated in the plasma, the these same set of proteins in people who are about to develop dementia or who already have dementia may be depleted. And so you may go from seeing an overabundance to a relative depletion in the same person at two different stages. Now, weren't able to show this in the same person, but that hypothesis, and it was interesting that a lot of them were synaptic proteins in particular. Mm-hmm. I'll say another paper that was very similar to ours came out, and they actually were able to look at autosomal dominant Alzheimer's disease, where they could really give an accurate prediction of how far away someone was developing dementia. They measured a smaller subset of proteins, but they found something very similar, that there was like a depletion of synaptic proteins when people became symptomatic, but an upregulation about 20 to 30 years before people developed dementia symptoms. And this is in cerebrospinal fluid. So it was really neat to see these two different papers using two different types of disease, of Alzheimer's disease, and two different matrices, one using plasma, one using CSF, kind of come to converging conclusions. But I think it just, in broadly speaking, points to the complexity, like measuring biomarkers and how you can, you know, conclude different things depending on the time at which you measure these biomarkers in someone's disease mm-hmm. course.
And how did you measure the 5,000 proteins at once? Because was it using a quite new technique? Or
it was. So there's been, I think we're living in like the early 2000s of genetics, but for proteomics, like, yeah, it's really taking off. I mean, mass spec, which has been like the traditional way of doing proteomics. And when I say proteomics, I mean like just measuring a large segment of proteins in, you know, some sort of, you know, tissue or biospecimen. So, you know, we focus on plasma, you know, we work with people who focus on CSF and brain tissue, but, you know, it was really only doable with this technology called mass spec up until recently. Mass spec was the learning curve was steep. You had to sort of have an expert, in-house to do it. So it was really, it was less accessible than some of these newer platforms that are more like traditional immunoassays, although the actual technology is different. But, you know, with a small amount of biofluid, now with platforms like we use SomaLogic, SomaScan, there's also a competing platform that, yeah, I think is very strong as well, called Olink. And they're both, I think, the leaders right now in this, you know, more democratized version of proteomics. And, you know, with like 50 microliters or less, which is a tiny amount of blood, you know, you can get really reliable measures of a large segment of the proteome. And, you know, this is something that these companies have been doing maybe for 10-15 years, but with time they're expanding their ability, the breadth of their measurement. So, like, for example, the SomaScan, which is SomaLogic's platform, started with 1,000 proteins, and then it went to 1,300, then 5,000. We recently deployed like a SomaScan platform to measure 7,000 proteins on one of our cohorts, and I believe by next year we'll be able to do 10,000 proteins. So the technology is just getting better and better, and with the same amount of fluid, and you're seeing more and more of the proteome. And the proteome, yeah, it's estimated this is about 20,000 protein coding genes. And all of those protein coding genes, in addition to coding for different proteins, have various proteoforms, like, you know, these post-translational modifications or splicing variants that actually increase the diversity. So, you know, people have estimated, you know, maybe even 100,000 proteins or versions of proteins that are actually, you know, circulating in various, you know, tissue types that can be measured. And I think that's where it's going. But it is a boom period for proteomics. And, you know, my lab has been lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time.
And why did you adjust for, what was it, EGFR?
So EGFR is a marker of, well, EGFR stands for estimated glomerular filtration rate, right? So it's a marker of kidney function. And you know, the simple answer is that the kidney, depending on how well it's working, can influence the, you know, excretion of proteins from the blood. And so if people's kidneys aren't working as well as they should, you can see this buildup of specific, particularly the larger proteins in the bloodstream. And that can affect, you know, our measurement and our association. So by adjusting, and this is not something everyone does, and you know, there's definitely pros and cons, but we think by adjusting for kidney function, particularly in cohorts who have varying levels of kidney function, you have some people with more close to CKD or have chronic kidney disease, and some who are perfectly fine, we can sort of try to normalize for the varying levels of kidney function and see the protein signal that's independent of that. Kind of a pedantic, you know, very pragmatic reason, but I think one of the downsides is if kidney function is actually driving, or some of the markers of kidney function, like I think like B2M, that are driving, you know, they are known to have a role in renal disease or renal function, but they could also be driving some of the phenotypes that we're interested in. So I think by, you know, adjusting for kidney function, we may miss out on that. But I think the, on the opposite side of the argument is that, well, we may, you know, some of the proteins that we do see, if we don't adjust for kidney function, might just be markers of kidney disease and not disease-associated protein.
And how can your results be used to improve Alzheimer's disease diagnosis or treatment? Do you think that you could develop a new treatment using the proteins in plasma?
Not yet. We're not there yet. I mean, what we've done is identify some proteins that we want to prioritize, and we've even gone as far as, you know, suggesting one or two proteins from our set of discovered proteins that appear to be causal or mechanistically relevant. And that's probably the ones that we would prioritize highest in terms of, you know, looking into whether or not these proteins do indeed play a mechanistic role. If so, in what tissue? Is it only brain? Can we target them in the periphery and, you know, try to modulate the trajectory of the disease process itself? But again, something we're actively working on. My lab actually is not well positioned at this point to do those mechanistic follow-up studies because we don't, you know, we're not a basic science wet lab. So we're finding the right collaborators to try to do that because we do, you know, want to try to follow up on some of these targets that we've identified. But I think the maybe more near-term implications are, you know, biomarkers and pathway-specific biomarkers. Like, you know, with this set of proteins, for example, we have evidence that, you know, there's some early immune dysfunction. With this set of proteins, we have some evidence there's early synaptic dysfunction. And we can try to group people based on where we're seeing breakdowns in biologic processes that are specifically relevant to Alzheimer's disease. And that may drive treatments, that may drive sort of grouping or sort of subphenotyping of Alzheimer's disease, and all that can come from that with regard to the personalization of their treatment approach.
And are you thinking of expanding this work to do it with a different cohort of like more varied people inside the cohort, or larger cohort size, or different proteins or so on?
Yeah, we're involved in a few consortia, you know, bringing together cohorts to try to do things at larger scale. You know, we're fortunate enough to be working with a very large study to begin with. It is a unique study in terms of the timeline. You know, it started in the late 80s. It's, you know, we still have participants enrolled and that we're actually measuring proteins on now. And so it's hard to find someone with a similar study design to like to pair with, to pool data, even to replicate. It's like, hard to do an exact replication, but there are elements of our study that we can take and pull together with other studies, especially like the cross-sectional approaches, to do things, where we have more statistical power at a larger scale. And, for example, the subgroup analysis that we talked about, I think it would be great to do some more of that when we have bigger sample sizes and can replicate and meta-analyze data. So like that's where we're headed from a big data perspective. And then I mentioned from a more mechanistic perspective, we're really interested in following up on some of these potential therapeutic targets and potential biomarkers as well. And that's more of a narrower focus.
Mm-hmm. And what other work are you doing in the lab apart from, like, are you doing any other work apart from this?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of our work does involve proteomics. Mm-hmm. A lot of our work involves neuroimaging. A lot of our work involves like targeted biomarkers. So, we're making like risk scores to predict dementia by combining proteins. We're applying machine learning to do that. We're generating risk scores to predict other neurocognitive phenotypes like demyelination. And we think that, some of these risk scores may be because proteins are easy to measure. You can measure a lot of them with just a small amount of blood. There may be some clinical utility to going to the doctor's office and saying, I want to get 100 proteins measured so that I can get a sense of how at risk I am for this, that, and the other thing. So we're pursuing that, and we're also pursuing some more mechanistic questions or questions to really understand the disease biology, sort of leveraging our longitudinal cohorts that we have either in-house or that we collaborate with. Yeah, there's a lot going on, but a lot of it does involve the proteome, and because I think there's so much to do. And if people are interested, if there's grad students out there who are interested, with that said, I think it's a good plug for the fact that we're always or usually looking for postdoc fellows. So if this sparks someone's interest, we'd be happy. Please get in touch with me. Yeah, we'd be happy to talk about for a future in the Mind Lab.
Mm-hmm. That moves on nicely to my next question. What advice would you give to students who want to come into this area?
One, it's a great area to be in. Two, I think it's hard to give broad advice. I love mentoring. I like talking to students. Everyone's sort of coming from a different place. Some students just like feel, like they can do anything and they can conquer the world, and sometimes they can. And then there's some people who are tremendously talented but like don't have the confidence or just like the understanding that, hey, this is possible. So, I mean, one thing, if I can just speaking broadly, the possibilities in terms of research, and this is why I love it, are really almost limitless. Like you can, you get your PhD, and it almost even doesn't matter what you get it in, because as long as you like learning, the field moves so fast that whatever you got your PhD in, good chance it'll be obsolete or near obsolete, and you're going to be learning something else and applying new skills anyway. And so the profession, it can be a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. It's a grind, but it's like lifelong learning. You meet tons of really cool, very smart people. One of the things I like most about it is like the team approach. It's super interdisciplinary, very collaborative. Building a network of collaborators and friends is like extremely, extremely important to success in this area, in my opinion. And it's also one of the things that makes it fun. So, I think the possibilities are really, really limitless, as long as you're willing to put in the work. But don't be afraid to jump into something new or learn something new, because just like me in proteomics, I have no formal training in it. It's sort of new enough that there really isn't a playbook. There's no courses or anything. And we take a little bit from epidemiology, take a little bit from genetics, and use content knowledge regarding, you know, Alzheimer's disease, neurobiology. It's really just mashing things together and, you know, hopefully it makes sense. And then we have peer review and they can tell me if it makes sense or not. And, you know, we have a bunch of very critical collaborators who can tell me if it makes sense. And so, yeah, that's what's fun. You know, you can get to be creative.
And this is more, this is a general question I like asking. What do you do in like your spare time apart from research?
What do I do? Well, I have a newborn. So right now she takes up most of my time. She's 5 months old. Okay. But before that, I do a lot of distance running. I do ultra marathons on the trail.
How long is the ultra marathon?
It's anything above 20, anything longer than a marathon is considered an ultra.
Okay.
But like I wasn't like that crazy with it. I do like 50 Ks, so about 30 something miles. But I like running on the mountains and the trails, and I live next to the Appalachian Trail. So that's on purpose. That's not an accident because I can, you know, easily go out and spend time in the woods. I think that, you know, just like getting outdoors, you know, sometimes, you know, just fishing, hiking, whatever. And then now we moved out to what they call a farmette, which is like a small farm. So that like keeps me super busy, just with maintaining it.
Do you have like, do you grow any actual like plant crops, or do you mean to grow like?
Yeah, so we grow hay. It's very low maintenance. Yeah, we have some acreage and we grow hay. We have people who come by twice a summer and clip it, bale it up, and we actually give it to our neighbor who has a bunch of cows and horses and goats. So it's a way to like maintain the land at no expense to us. We don't take a profit or anything. Yeah, I just enjoy the quiet, the privacy, the beauty of being out here. So that's, I think a lot of people in science find that surprising because there's not a lot, you know, it's not that typical.
I've never found a scientist who like
exactly
in that but sense.
I know a few, like there's more than you think when you start, it's like, oh, like this person has a farm too. This person. So like there's a subset who are like, yeah, to hell with the city. And they, they move out. But I didn't know of them until I did it myself. And then sort of you kind of come together and you're like, oh yeah, you raise like animals. And
so, are you thinking of having like, I don't know, chickens or cow or sheep or something?
Yeah, I think eventually, we've only been here for 3 years.
Okay.
So eventually we'll want to do that. But we need to get the kid, potentially kids, out of infanthood first.
Yeah, and you've actually got time to
do it. Yeah,
that makes sense.
Assume someone's going to want a horse at some point, so.
Yeah, I've always wanted to go horse riding, never been, but.
Oh, yeah, you got to do it. It's tons of fun.
I need to go. Do you have any particularly favorite books that you would recommend? And this can be nonfiction or fiction.
So one of the books that I really like is called The Hard Thing About Hard Things. It's by, I know we were talking about A16Z and sort of the like venture capital people earlier, but it's by one of the this like tech CEO who became super, you know, wealthy and, you know, successful in the, you know, .com era. But he talks about like we're starting up this company and being at the helm and through like the boom and bust period and just like the challenges of sort of being in charge of like this group and, you know, people's lives and livelihoods and, you know, all that comes with, you know, being a CEO. And, you know, he sort of boils it down into some lessons, some takeaways. He talks about like some of the stories, which are pretty incredible. But I think of sort of running a lab. There's a lot of similarities in, you know, to running like a small sort of business, right, or a startup. You're in charge of, you know, funding and financing. You're in charge of you know, generating output, which in our world is, you know, publications and, you know, actual contributions to the science. Mm-hmm. And you have like this freedom to go in whatever direction you think, you know, will be most, you know, profitable in terms of scientific, you know, insights. So I, even though, yeah, I haven't really found a good, like, you know, how to be a PI book, but, and I don't even know if I'd want to read something like that.
Yeah.
But I do find a lot of good insights from, like, the business world or the startup world. And one of the best books that I've read in that category is The Hard Thing About Hard Things. The author, it's either Ben Horowitz or Mark Andreessen, one of them. But that was probably one of my favorite. I guess that's not, I don't really do much fiction.
I mix between both, really. So I like asking the question because people always have a few books that I would never find.
Yeah.
I would never have come across this book. But now that I have them, I'm almost like, oh, yeah, I'm going to read it. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's Ben Horowitz. I just looked it up, the author. But yeah, it's a really good read.
That's all the questions I've got. It was great about that. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, take care.
Bye.
Dr. Keenan Walker, like most scientists I've found, have an interest in exploring during the younger ages. That means that all of us can be scientists, as we all have that drive to explore. Some of us just lose it because we think something else is more important. Found it interesting also how he decided that clinical neuroscience was for him, as it seemed to have happened slightly by chance, which is another good hope, because with science you don't always have to be constantly driven towards it. Sometimes the field you want to go into can be. The paper was amazing, but we can't cover all the 5,000 proteins, so you'll have to read more in the paper if you want to find out a more detailed look into certain proteins. Firstly, we talked about Alzheimer's disease, and there are many problems with Alzheimer's disease. And by this, I mean that our understanding of Alzheimer's disease is still quite low. He thinks that many things lead to amyloid and tau, which are the two proteins that are thought to be the main causes of Alzheimer's disease. And he also thinks that they then lead to the problems such as mitochondrial dysfunction and protein clearance problems. Amyloid therapies are great first step, but we need to find the group of people that respond well and not so well to these therapies. Proteomic signature. He looked at the proteome. So that's the proteins, blood of people who had dementia early or later on, and that means people who had it in their fourth decade of life or their sixth decade of life. And his results showed that one key protein was GDF15, which had a strong link, and it was found that doubling the level of GDF15 caused a 50% increase in your likelihood of Alzheimer's. I also found it quite fascinating that the similarities between females and males are pretty similar. But that kind of makes sense because we are all human in the end. But the reason I was quite shocked by that is that females in general get Alzheimer's disease more commonly, and they also get it at an earlier age sometimes. But there were a few differences. And I just want to highlight that these differences, they might not be the reason for the differences that in the amount of people that get Alzheimer's disease between males and females, but it's important to know that this is the case. And one protein was Serafina 3, which is involved in the immune system. But I also liked how we looked at people who got the disease earlier on compared to people who got it later on. And it was found that they had different proteins expressed in the blood. And in general, the people who had later onset of Alzheimer's disease had increased biosynthesis markers and protein clearance. Keenan thinks that this is due to the fact that you will get different changes in the disease processes. His lab also does machine learning and neuroimaging to find ways to better understand and diagnose Alzheimer's disease. I find this is very interesting and believe it would be brilliant. This means this research is important. It's just the beginning of a full area of research and hopefully lead to better cures and researches. If you're interested in Alzheimer's disease and you would like to join his lab, check him out. Thank you for listening to this episode, and I would be grateful for a like, a review, or sharing this episode. If you could do one or three of these things, it would be a great help in helping more people get a grasp of neuroscience, which I believe everyone should do. And I will ensure more people, and I will ensnare more people in the net of neuroscience, my evil goal. If you have any comments, be sure to send them to the Brain Explained email, Twitter, LinkedIn, or website, or just leave it on the episode. As a final note, if you want to get involved with the podcast, I would be delighted to have you on board. I always need people to write blog posts about interesting neuroscience, work on the podcast, or on promotion. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I look forward to releasing more interesting neuroscience. So stay tuned to learn more about the brain.